Raised on Foundations of Slime, written and read by Amelia Groom. On a recent flight to Amsterdam, I read a chapter about the 17th century Dutch landscape painter Jan van Goyen in Lytle-Shaw's book New Grounds for Dutch Landscape. Shaw presents van Goyen as a guy obsessed with mud during an age of intensifying land reclamation efforts in the swaggy, swampy place now known as the Netherlands. It took enormous efforts to pull these lowlands out of the wetness, dam and dike building, peat dredging, draining the lakes and ponds, and erecting thousands of windmills for pumping water from the ground and sending it towards the redirected rivers and constructed canal systems. The process, of course, is never finished. It takes ongoing management to push the swamp away. The grand old Amsterdam canal houses lean into each other as the underground poles that stabilize them rot in the moist depths. Land reclamation fights with swamp reclamation because the swamp always remembers where it was. Bearing witness to the national project of separating land from water in the Dutch Golden Age, van Goyen often painted muddiness as his subject matter. He also, according to Shaw, painted as if he were reenacting the land reclamation process. He was known for painting wet on wet, slathering his panels with puddles of gloopy oil paint before gradually differentiating legible forms and drawing them out from the primordial ooze. In Shaw's words, he pulled his pictures out of murky expanses of oil paint in much the way Dutch land itself was produced through pumping and draining. At the same time, van Goyen's paintings also maintained a quality of non-differentiation, signaling that the mud is still there and that the process of separating the dry from the wet was always incomplete, always reversible. As Shaw writes, in a culture obsessed with, organized around, and literally built on the most advanced processes of differentiating matter, especially water from dirt, van Goyen's entire project is one of suspending this differentiation, continually returning matter to its undifferentiated state. The poorly sorted substance of van Goyen's paintings analogizes the pre-processed swamps that previously constituted Dutch land and might, in the event of flooding, envelop it again. I finished reading the chapter shortly before landing at Schiphol Airport. While we were waiting on the tarmac, I took out my phone and searched for van Goyen's painting, View of Haarlem and the Haarlemmermeer, from 1646. I wanted to take a look at what Shaw describes as the intermingling of land and water in this landscape, which is more like a mudscape. I zoomed in on the pair of poorly differentiated figures in the midground, figures who are, in Shaw's words, barely differentiated from the oozing ground plain. Where is the Haarlemmermeer? I wondered. I looked it up and discovered it was right underneath me. Strange feeling. All of us on the tarmac were on top of a disappeared lake. The whole wetland area was drained in the 19th century, and Schiphol was built on the dried-out ground. I looked out the window of the plane and tried hard to imagine the swirling, marshy terrain of van Goyen's picture, where the ground is soft and sticky, and everything sinks into it and gets muddied by it. Part 2, Vanquished by Wetness. Looking at the poorly differentiated figures in van Goyen's painting, I'm reminded of a muddy rugby match that I learned about from the artist Joseph Noonan-Ganley. Basically, the stadium at Cardiff Arms Park in Wales was built on land reclaimed from the River Taff, and it tended to get very muddy, especially during wet weather. On one particularly wet day in January 1970, things got so muddy that the rugby players began to lose their distinction from the ground, from the environment, and from each other. As Noonan-Ganley writes, the boundaries of the team's sense of self were compromised by the mud. The application of the mud messes up the division between players. Their squad numbers taken away, their team's fidelity is occluded. End quote. K. chaos ensued. The players couldn't control their movements. They slid around, got stuck together, struggled to remain vertical, struggled to even lift the ball up out of the mud, and ended up in a pile all covered in muck. Mud messes with boundaries and categorization and progress. It likes commingling and it likes horizontality. It makes heavy things sink. It makes the upright slip over. It's very difficult to erect vertical structures on muddy grounds. They won't stay up. Mud can introduce slowness too. Suddenly my feet are feet of mud. It all goes slow-mo, sings Kate Bush in her best, in my humble opinion, song, Suspended in Gaffer. When someone is swamped with deadlines, they're overwhelmed and struggling to move forward efficiently. When a situation becomes a quagmire, everything is muddled and extrication is difficult. When things get bogged down in bureaucracy, progress is obstructed. When playing stuck in the mud, getting stuck in the mud means you can't move forward. But mud isn't only about getting stuck. As the rugby players in Wales learned, it's also about lubrication, slippage, and quick, unpredictable movement. Mud is a slimy substance, and in the words of V. Barrett from VNS Matrix, an Australian cyberfeminist collective self-described as merchants of slime, who crawled out of the cyber swamp back in 1991, slime is interstitial. It moves through narrow openings and occupies the gaps between things. Male Fantasies, Klaus Telwelite's two-volume study of the German fascist imagination, opens with an image of a vintage postcard showing a train crossing the Hindenburg Dam. It's surrounded by tumultuous waters, with waves breaking right onto the tracks. But in heroic defiance of the elements, the train moves full steam ahead. The Hindenburg Dam, which was opened in 1927, is an 11-kilometer-long causeway forming part of the Marsh Railway, a train line that runs through marshlands in the north of Germany. As the point of departure for Tewelite's study, the triumphalist image sets up one of his central themes, the fascist fear of mud. He goes on to trace a deep-seated anxiety about wetness and swampiness running through the writings of the men who formed the Freikorps military volunteer units in the aftermath of World War I. Refusing to disarm after the war, these men banded together to suppress the revolutionary German working class and fight Soviet communism. They were crucial to the rise of National Socialism, and some of them later became high-ranking Nazis. Examining the Freikorpsmen's diaries and letters, Tewelite looks at how their fear of revolution involved fears of wetness and seepage. Again and again throughout the literature, Tewelite encounters imagery of waves, tides, streams, torrents, floods, and oceanic surges that threaten to inundate society, engulf bodies, and transgress boundaries. The Freikorpsmen imagined themselves rescuing Germany from the Bolshevistic flood. Striving to become a rock amidst the raging sea, they set out to form a hard barrier against the stream of insurgents that pours like the great deluge. They struggled to dam up the raging Polish torrent and ensure that the red flood is finally washed away. Swampy metaphors of mire, mud, and morass also abound. The Freikorpsmen imagine themselves staving off the muddy tide of revolution, just as the wave of Marxist mire was cresting, so that Germany would not sink into the red morass. Similar metaphors of watery inundation have, in more recent decades, been a staple of anti-immigration racism. In 1978, Margaret Thatcher declared that people are really rather afraid that this country might be rather swamped by people with a different culture. In 1996, Senator Pauline Hanson announced, in her first speech to the Australian Parliament, that the nation was in danger of being swamped by Asians. The mainstream media of the global north frequently reports on the streams of migrants and waves of refugees that are pouring in, flowing in, and flooding in. Migrants flood Greek island of Lesbos, reads a New York Times headline. This tidal wave of migrants could be the biggest threat to Europe since the war, declares the Daily Mail. The anxiety that is evoked through these dehumanizing ecological metaphors is always related to an imagined loss of control. It's a dread of slipping, of contamination, of disillusion, and of losing white homogeneity and dominance. Thévelight suggests that the Freikorpsmen of the early 20th century feared the swamp because they feared drowning and engulfment. They had to stand as hard pillars of dryness and security so that the murky depths of revolution would not swallow them up. Part of the terror of the swamp was that it could absorb objects without changing in the process. It was thus dreaded as an entity that held hidden things, things from secret realms and from the domain of the dead. The soldier males, as Thévelight calls them, strived to erect themselves as heroic, towering bodies with fixed boundaries. They stood upright, not just clearly, but also honestly. The swamp was not honest. It was a deceptive realm of hybridity, ambiguity, quote-unquote Jewish impurity, and quote-unquote feminine wetness and softness. It was where substances mixed, edges broke down, and movements were multi-directional. The movement of the train in Hindenburg Dam postcard is clearly directed. The train is elevated above the water and literally on track with a predetermined destination. The water down below, by contrast, is non-linear. It moves in multiple directions at once, with fleeting eruptions of force that slosh around unpredictably. If the fascist dread of the swamp relates to fears of wetness, disorder, dissolution, horizontality, softness, spillage, and uncontainability, as well as fears around losing the hard sovereignty of the autonomous self, what does the inverse of this dread look like? What would it mean to embrace mud and its capacity for defilement, to get into the wetness of the ground and to let it get into you, to want to be where things are messy and in unpredictable motion, to want to move like slime, oozing through interstitial spaces and lubricating the slippage of things, to relate to the world through its squishy permeability, to appreciate the ground as a responsive and relational place, a place that receives and remembers things without striving for vertically erected permanence. To, in the words of C. Riley Snorton, play in the mud, which is to say, to refuse formal techniques of classification. Ursula K. Le Guin wrote a tiny text called Being Taken for Granite, in which she declared, I wish that those who take me for granite would once in a while treat me like mud. Granite, Le Guin notes, appears upright, immovable, and unchangeable. It makes pinnacles and does not accept footprints. Mud, on the other hand, lies around being wet and heavy and oozy and generative. Le Guin acknowledges that such squishy, unstable footing can leave some feeling insecure and resentful. Maybe they fear they might be sucked in and swallowed, she muses. But she wants to embrace her muddiness, her capacity to remain low down in the mess of relational entanglements and their movements, which leave her all full of footprints and deep, deep holes and tracks and traces and changes. The subversive potential of mud can also come into play in a more literal sense. See, for instance, Mud and ACAB, a short section of the pamphlet We Are Nature Defending Itself by Issa Frimaux and Jay Jordan of the Laboratory of Insurrectionary Imagination. In this publication, Frimaux and Jordan offer an account of their involvement with the ZAD, or Zone 2 Defend, in France, a rural protest camp and experiment in commoning with dozens of collective living spaces occupying over 4,000 acres of wetlands, fields, and forests. For decades, the farmer and squatter communities of the Zaad have fought to defend the territory and prevent an unnecessary airport from being built there, while the French state has repeatedly tried and failed to evict them. Recalling a particularly brutal eviction attempt in 2012, Firmot and Jordan write about how the mud became an accomplice for the residents. Battalions of riot police were sent in from across France, but as they tried to navigate the sorgue terrain that they had no understanding of, the weight of their armament caused them to sink and succumb to the earth's wet grip. As the residents began throwing handfuls of mud at them, the cops became increasingly disoriented and immobilized. The sludge showered onto their visors, blocking their vision. Some of the residents found that if the mud was aimed just right, it would slide down and fill the cops' body armor, so that they could no longer bend at the knees and they would start toppling down into the gloop. The 2012 eviction attempt was a spectacular failure, and the Zaad has since succeeded in stopping the new airport project. For Frémaux and Jordan, the wetness of the ground offered more than just a useful material in this fight. It also became a part of their political imagination. As they wrote at the time, "The word humble, like the word human, has its roots in humus. It literally means return to earth. Perhaps the future will be built by heroic acts of humility rather than arrogant temples to growth. Perhaps civilization's dream to suck this zone dry with its concrete and tarmac, steel and plastic, will be vanquished by wetness." Part 3. Ruins in the Marshes. My interest in wet grounds began with my research on the artist Beverly Buchanan and her marsh ruins, an environmental sculpture erected in the intertidal coastal wetlands of Brunswick on the southeast coast of Georgia in 1981. The work is still there, three solid ruinous boulders built from concrete and tabi, which have been slowly crumbling and descending into the mud for more than four decades. When she was in the early stages of planning the marsh ruins, Beverly Buchanan wrote in a letter to her friend Lucy Lepard that she was trying to imagine a site near water. Near the ocean would be ideal, she said, so that eventually the piece would be taken in. During this era, Buchanan often worked with bodies of water as sites of ecological entanglement and as agents of sculptural formation and deformation. She lived in Macon, a small town in central Georgia, and she made several artworks with the Ocmulgee River, sending floating objects off to be pulled away by its currents and leaving some of her sculptures submerged in its waters. When she traveled to Denmark in the summer of 1980, she made an ephemeral stone work called Six-Piece Abandoned Sculpture at the water's edge on a beach at Kronborg Castle. As the tides came in and started rearranging the abandoned fragments, she took a series of photographs to document the work's undoing. The marsh ruins, similarly, were constructed in the liminal zone where the water meets the land. And when the tides are high, the work becomes partially submerged. After traveling to Brunswick to see the marsh ruins back in 2019, I wrote a short book on the work. I spent some time thinking about Buchanan's approach to ruination and what it means for an artist to make sculptures that are, at their very outset, conceived as ruins. With hindsight, I can say that I spent far less time in the book grappling with the other word in the work's title, marsh. The marshland is, in many ways, a deeply significant site to choose for a major environmental sculpture in the deep south of the US. Things that are erected on muddy grounds are destined to sink and fall, messing with figure ground and nature culture bifurcations on their way down. Wetlands are zones of instability and ambiguity. They're difficult to traverse, difficult to understand, and difficult to instrumentalize in accordance with colonial logics. In her work on ecologies of resistance in the plantation zone, Monique Alloward describes how the swamp stymied colonial armies and cartographers and compromised the order and productivity of imperial ventures from explorations to plantations. Throughout the southern landscapes that Buchanan grew up in and later made work in dialogue with, swamps are also highly significant in histories of Black fugitive freedom as sites that harbored Maroon communities and their alternative life worlds. I've recently been trying to think and read about the aesthetics of mud and the significance of swamps in histories of counter-colonial resistance. This essay is an attempt to bring together some of the myriad strands of thought and research that I'm moving through, and some of the artists, activists, and scholars whose work has been guiding me. The text can be read as an oblique postscript to the Beverly Buchanan Marsh Ruins book. There is always more to say about Buchanan's inexhaustible work. Like a marshland ecology, the marsh ruins are a site of uncontainable, leaky abundance. While this essay is not directly about Buchanan, she's very much a part of its ecology, and its lines of inquiry have seeped out from my encounter with her swampy environmental sculpture. Part 4, Sucked In. I open this essay with Van Goyen's mudscapes. His paintings bear witness to early 17th century Dutch land reclamation practices on a local scale, but these practices were also globally entangled. He was born in 1596, the very year that marks the start of the Dutch involvement with the transatlantic slave trade. He was 6 years old when the Dutch East India Company, VOC, was founded in 1602. By the time he painted View of Harlem and the Harlem Amir in 1646, the quote-unquote humanist prince and human enslaver, John Maurice, had already returned to Europe after his years as the governor of Dutch Brazil, the first Dutch Atlantic slave society and plantation colony, which was built on the stolen indigenous lands of the northeast coast of Brazil. Elizabeth A. Sutton describes how Maurice Stadt, which Prince Maurice founded as the capital city of Dutch Brazil, was, like so much of Holland, constructed on low-lying marshy grounds that were drained and reclaimed through a canal system. The Dutch endeavored to remake the local environment in their own image wherever they went in the so-called New World, including New Amsterdam, the settlement founded in 1625 on the swampy grounds of the stolen Lenape territory that is now known as Lower Manhattan. Memories of the suppressed, watery past are still held in the financial district's heavily paved streets, which now support the extreme vertical reach of towering skyscrapers. The curve of Pearl Street is the curve of the original shoreline. The name was Paarlestraat in Dutch, a reference to the prominent Lenape shell midden that the settlers destroyed, using its white oyster shell fragments to pave the road. When the settlers used landfill to extend the shoreline into the East River, they built a street that runs in a straight line in front of Pearl Street. This street was often washed over with the salty waters of the river during high tide, which is why it has the name Water Street. Dutch mud management techniques were also imported to the region now known as Indonesia and to the Dutch colonies in South America. Shortly before he was assassinated, the Guyanese Marxist historian Walter Rodney described how Dutch enslavers established their plantations along Guyana's coast by overseeing the transformation of the region's swampy ecology through techniques of sea defense and land reclamation. Quote, the people of the Low Countries gave to the world the concept of a polder, referring to a piece of usable land created by digging and then draining a water-covered area. End quote. This is Rodney noting that the arduous work of making the land usable by draining the mud and constructing elaborate systems of canals, dams, and dikes was entirely dependent on the labor of generations of Black and Indigenous enslaved and indentured workers. In her study of the intertwined histories of cartography and capitalism in the Dutch Golden Age, Sutton looks at the significance of the Beemster Polder that was founded just north of Amsterdam in 1608. The Beemster was a huge marshy lake area that was drained over several years and made into a dry grid of parceled out property. As the largest polder in the Netherlands and the first corporate land reclamation investment scheme, the Beemster was hailed as a triumph over water and a statement of Dutch power over nature. When the English embarked on major land reclamation projects in the first half of the 17th century, they turned to Dutch drainage engineers and their literally world-changing technology. The General Drainage Act was passed in 1600 for making dry and profitable many hundred thousands of acres of marshes in the English Fenlands. Vittoria de Palma has shown that while the region was dismissed as a wasteland and a mere quagmire, the fens had in fact long been a bountiful commons for local peasant foragers. She notes that the Dutch produced the maps, the engineers, the venture capitalists, and in many cases the workers who remade the fen landscape to fit a different model of productivity. The result was a land no longer held in common, but now divided into plots, traced out, numbered, and ready to enter the realm of private rather than communal property. Part 5. The Swamp, an Insurgent Ecology. It should be noted that the draining of swamps for purposes of crop cultivation is not necessarily tied to colonial systems. In her book, Black Rice, The African Origins of Rice Cultivation in the Americas, Judith A. Carney shows how the plantation economy along the South Carolina and Georgia coast, the area where Buchanan built her marsh ruins, was completely dependent on the knowledges and skills that were bought by enslaved people from regions of West Africa, where coastal wetland reclamation had long been practiced. But racial capitalism changes everything. In Sylvia Winter's formulation, Western man initiates an entirely new relation with the natural environment, one in which, as Descartes proposed in 1637, we render ourselves the lords and possessors of nature. According to Winter, this new relation only comes to realize itself with the discovery of the New World and its vast exploitable lands. Previously, she suggests, all societies existed in what the Negritude poet and critic Leopold Sédar Senghor describes as the dual oscillatory process in which man adapts to nature and nature and adapts nature to his own needs. But under what Winter refers to as the impulsion of the market economy, this kind of reciprocity between humans and nature was lost. Nature was converted into land, conceivable only in terms of property, laid bare of myth, custom, tradition, Winter writes. The catastrophic brutality of the Middle Passage is an inextricable part of this shift, since land, quote, if it were to function as land, needed not men, not communities, but so many units of labor power, end quote. When environments and racialized bodies are supposed to be reduced to property that is rationally utilized in service to capital, the swamp presents a problem. Christian morality already had a long history of satanizing the swamp and condemning wetlands as sites of evil and hellishness. As Rod Giblet has shown through readings of Beowulf, Dante, Milton, Tolkien, and other canonical texts that are infused with Christian traditions of theologizing the landscape. When it comes to the reduction of nature to land as privatized profit-making property, wetlands are frequently denigrated as uninhabitable, impenetrable, and unnavigable zones that needed to be improved and civilized through dredging, draining, and drying out. Through the eyes of the colonizer, the swamp was associated with rot and stench and death and disease and pollution and mess and monstrosity and femininity and waste and danger and loss. In her cultural history of the Okefeneke swamp in southeast Georgia, situated just inland from where Buchanan built her marsh ruins, Megan Kate Nelson describes how the muck and mire of the swamp stymied the military actions of U.S. soldiers in their war against the Seminole people. Uncontainable and untamable, squishy and trembling, the swamp came to embody their failure to achieve control over nature and power over other people. Swamps also frustrated colonial efforts in cartography and stable categorization. To be rendered legible, mappable, divisible, and predictably productive, the wetlands needed to be turned into drylands. Ecologically, the effects of this Western aversion to the swamp have been disastrous. Ecologists estimate that as much as 87% of the planet's wetlands have been made to disappear in the last three centuries. With that disappearance comes extreme loss of life and of complex life systems. Wetlands host remarkable biodiversity. One statistic says that wetland areas currently make up 5% of the surface of the planet, but more than 40% of all species live or breed in them. They support diverse food systems and provide crucial stopover points for migratory birds. They can absorb and store vast amounts of carbon, which means substantial greenhouse gas emissions result from their drainage and destruction. Wetlands filter the groundwater by trapping sediments and pollutants. Since they can sponge up and slowly re-release water, they also act as buffer systems protecting from storms, floods, droughts, rising sea levels, and shoreline erosion. When wetlands are destroyed, so too is this protection. Colonial aspirations for absolutely totalizing environmental control and rationalization were, however, never fully achieved. There were always swamp areas that remained beyond the reach of white instrumentalization and surveillance in the New World, and as a result, these areas became the primary locus of marinage and black fugitive freedom. Resisting recapture, by using intimate understanding of the wetland ecology, self-liberated black maroons were sheltered in the depths of the swamp, often living alongside dispossessed native people, white felons and vagabonds, and other rebels and outcasts. This was certainly the case in the landscapes of the southern U.S. where Buchanan lived and worked, with places like the Great Dismal Swamp of Virginia and North Carolina, where thousands of the formerly enslaved and their descendants found refuge and formed alternative life worlds throughout the 18th and 19th centuries. The lush ecology of the swamp provided sustenance and myriad protections to those who fled from bondage and racial violence. The density of growth could be a shield that muffled sound and occluded visibility, and the muddy wetness could help to mask the body's smell so that the vicious bloodhounds, trained by plantation owners and patrollers, would lose their scent trail. At the same time, the conditions were often extremely harsh. Harriet Jacobs writes in Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl from 1861 about hiding out as a runaway in Snaky Swamp, an area of the Dismal Swamp in Chauhan County, North Carolina. She was ill and feverish and terrified of the snakes that crawled all over her, but she recalls that those large venomous snakes were less dreadful to my imagination than the white men in that community called civilized. It was precisely because these zones were so difficult and so reviled that the swamp offered refuge from white society. Willie Jamal Wright has written about the extent to which the practice of marinage was incumbent on the existence of unruly environments, swamps, but also high mountains, dense forests, and other places that were consigned as inaccessible, inhospitable, not yet profitable, and that were therefore illegible within the spatial imaginary of the participants of the plantocracy. In Wright's words, landscapes of marinage are those difficult terrains that marginalized, hunted, and exploited people have made habitable. areas where communities have taken a desire for liberation and merged it with an ignored and undervalued environment to gain liberties in oppression, to gain liberties in opposition to the repressive administrations. In this sense, the enslavers were right to fear the swamp. As a site of resistance and Black and Indigenous fugitivity, the swamp was a threat to the racial hierarchies of the settler colonial order. Catherine Benjamin Golden has argued that the Great Dismal Swamp did more than harbor fugitives and maroon communities. Its presence in the landscape also emanated the possibility of freedom and insurrection. This is what Golden terms the insurgent ecology of the Dismal Swamp. Throughout the surrounding areas, the swamp's looming presence beckoned defiance of oppressive law and order and offered physical encouragement to enslaved insurgency and rebellion. Part 6, Sinking Could Be an Elevation. This essay is accompanied by a series of images from Jota Mombasa, an artist whose work over the last several years has been engaged with watery submersions, mud inscriptions, and what she refers to as the radicality of sinking. Mombasa was born in Natal, a port city that was the target of the Dutch invasion of Brazil in 1633. For a brief time, the city was, just like Manhattan, known as New Amsterdam. While she was an artist in residence at the Rijksakademie in Amsterdam, Mombasa became attuned to the murky depths of the city's canals. She began making contact with these opaque repositories through a sculptural practice that involves rituals of submersion, immersion, and re-emergence. Bundles of fabric are chained up and lowered into the waters, where they're left for weeks on end to become what Mombasa refers to as ghosts. When they are eventually pulled back up, the fabrics are marked by the undoings of grime and time. They may have accrued frayed corners, clinging sediments, rust stains, traces of interaction from fish and other forms of underwater life, scratches and snags from encounters with rocks or other submerged entities, and all kinds of warpings and impressions from the algae, the salts, and the muddy depths. In order to be converted into a ghost, Mombasa says, the linen and the metal just have to wait while the underwater forms and deforms them. It's impossible to predict what kinds of formations and deformations will arise. Since a large part of the process is literally out of the artist's hands, there is a necessary acceptance of the fact that she is not in a position of total control. But it also goes beyond acceptance. There is enjoyment and relief found in the loss of containment and control. As the artist suggests in her video Water Will, the blessing of decomposition is that it offers an abolition of progress and order. Mombasa says, I like to relate to my practice not as its master, but rather as its channel. With her notion of the radicality of sinking, she refers to the process of abandoning oneself into the water's embrace, giving up the fantasy of control, and allowing the water to take hold. There's deep resonance here with the practice of Buchanan, another artist who worked with water as a historical repository, as a hiding place, and as a force of transience and transformation. Like Mombasa, Buchanan refused to occupy the position of the all-controlling master. She was very patient and precise in her intentions for her sculptures, but she was also always concerned with listening to her materials and letting them exist in evolving relation to their settings. She enjoyed stepping back and watching her creations move away from her authorial intentions, and she celebrated the pleasure that she found in relinquishing control. As can be seen, for instance, in the playful calendar that she made for friends with the title Out of Control from the year 2000. Throughout Mombasa's sunken works, there is a commitment to being, as she put it in her 2022 poem Visa Denied, in touch with the mud, as in engulfed by its embrace. My own thinking on mud and swamps is very much indebted to Mombasa's practice and the conversations we've had around it, which I hope will continue. In the years since her first experiments with the Amsterdam canals, the artist has gone on to work with other bodies of water, the Venetian Lagoon, the San Francisco Bay, the Waldsee Lake in Berlin, and, in the recent body of work that's depicted in these photographs, the Loire River in France. There's always site-specific research and response, but at the same time, Mombasa wants to relate to the waters as figures of interconnectedness and global historical entanglements. In her words, the bodies of water speak of place, but they also defy locality, as what is constitutive in every relationship they form with the sunken textiles is one of currents and motion. End quote. Rather than representing a site through the depiction of discrete objects, the ghosts are images that are gradually imbued with their settings, including the movements and layers of time that are held within them. For Ghost 7, 1-7, French Historical Maladie, a recent body of work produced in Nantes on the west coast of France, Mombasa worked with the heavily polluted and profoundly haunted waters of the Loire River, where it meets the tidal surges of the Atlantic Ocean. This is a site where the Atlantic seeps into the ostensibly solid and delineated land of the European continent. Quote, deeply marked by the development of global logistics and colonial expansion, the Loire Atlantique axis is one of revolted waters, unpredictable tides, and decomposed bodies. This is Mombasa remarking at the time of production, and she continued, the mud is abundant, their smells are pungent, so much hurt that is impossible to translate, and yet, in the offerings of the river, I found this beauty to which I'm grateful, a terrible beauty that unites all of us, the colonized, through the common acknowledgement of the seeds of disintegration rooted in colonial modernity. With the Loire, I extend the rotten tongue of our anti-colonial dissatisfactions. I rant, I curse, and I vomit. These hauntingly beautiful ghosts, which are fractures of a common language. Part 7. Plot or plotting. This essay was commissioned for a Dutch online platform that is dedicated to the plot as conceptualized by Sylvia Winter in the 1970s. The garden plots or provision grounds were small areas of land that were cultivated by the enslaved in the shadow of the plantation as a means of sustenance and survival. In texts including her unpublished manuscript, Black Metamorphosis, New Natives in a New World, and her article, Novel and History, Plot and Plantation, Winter compares the ideology and spatial logic of the plantation to that of the plot. The plantation spread itself over the most fertile and desirable land, while the plot was consigned to small, marginal, difficult terrains at the plantation's edges. The plantation grounds existed under regimes of intense scrutiny and surveillance, while the plot was often clandestine and tended after hours. While the plantation flattened out and instrumentalized the ground for maximally efficient monocultural production, with the resulting products sent far away for a world of abstract exchange value, the plot was for growing food in response to local needs as part of the immediate social context through concrete use value. On the plantation, the slave would, in Winter's words, represent the extreme case of alienation, dominating nature to create a product which was alien to his own needs and which alienated him from them. On the plot, however, his position was a dual and dynamic relationship in which he adapted himself to nature and also transformed nature. Winter does not simply romanticize the plot as wholly exterior to the plantation system. She observes that the plot and the plantation originate together in a single historical process, and that the plantation masters gave the slaves plots of land on which to grow food themselves in order to maximize profits. Crucially, however, this is not the whole story. It is in the undervalued and therefore relatively under-surveilled zones of the provision grounds that Winter locates the possibility for the flourishing of African diasporic folk cultures and cultural guerrilla resistance. The plot was an area of experience which reinvented and therefore perpetuated an alternative worldview, an alternative consciousness to that of the plantation. Winter continues, this worldview was marginalized by the plantation, but never destroyed. End quote. The alternative consciousness that was possible in the interstitial space of the plot was antagonistic to the ecocidal rationale of the plantation. While the ideology of the masters stressed the rights of property, the worldview of the African slaves remained based on a man's relation to the earth and, concomitantly, to the community, writes Winter. The enslaved transplanted to the plot all the structure of values that had been created by traditional societies of Africa. In these societies, the earth was the basis of the community's existence and could not be alienated as private property. On the plantation, the earth was turned into land, where the labor power of the enslaved contributed to the technical conquest of nature. On the plot, however, the land remained the earth, and the earth was a goddess. Man used the land to feed himself and to offer first fruits to the earth. His funeral was the mystical reunion with the earth. End quote. Edouard Glisson also identified the plot as a possible site of counter-colonial environmental praxis. Speaking with filmmaker Mantia Diawara while sitting outside in the sun in his native Martinique, the poet and philosopher of opacity and relationality emphasized the fact that cultivating plants in such small cast-off spaces meant cultivating intimate knowledge about how different species could grow alongside each other while protecting and nurturing one another through subterranean relations. The plantation had orderly rows of a single crop laid out across a cleared field. In contrast to this coercive monoculturalism and hyper-legibility, Glisson describes how the provision grounds, which he referred to as Jardin Créole, were secretive sites of diverse multiplicities and cross-species interdependencies. In a very narrow space, he says, they were able to grow dozens of different types of trees, different scents, coconuts, yams, oranges, pines, dashine, chotune, sweet potatoes, cassava. They did it in such a way that the plants mutually protected each other. It was the essence of the Creole garden. To consider the plot in this way is to consider the edges of the physical space of the plantation, as well as the limits of its genocidal, ecocidal, and epistemicidal violence. The worldviews that were sustained in the provision grounds were, in Winter's words, marginalized but never destroyed. So what happens if the swamp is brought in to triangulate the plot plantation dialectic? These two zones, the plot and the plantation, do not account for the entirety of the eco-historical setting. While many wetlands were drained and cleared to facilitate settler productions of space, there were always those recalcitrant terrains that remained, however temporarily, beyond the reach of total surveillance, legibility, and extractive productivity. Existing as it did in a marginalized relation to the plantation, the plot could be a place for plotting escape, a place where the enslaved could gather, organize, and imagine otherwise. Existing as it did even further away from the land that was valued as rationally productive, the swamp could sometimes be the setting into which the self-emancipated would flee, either as a stopover point or as a more permanent refuge. The swamp is not born from the same historical process as the plantation and the plot. It predates the racializing impulsion of the market economy, and it continues even after the imposition of that impulsion onto ecologies, bodies, and worldviews. And, unlike the expansive fields of the plantation and the narrow plots of the provision grounds, the ecology of the swamp defies clear delineation. It's a planetary figure of seepage and interconnectedness, spatially as well as temporally. It can be difficult to say where the swamp begins and ends. The swamp exists in the shifting and unknowable depths. Even when it has been drained, you can never be sure when or where its suppressed wetness might reappear. The pestilent marsh is drained with great labour and the sea is fenced off with mighty barriers, wrote the Scottish Enlightenment philosopher Adam Ferguson. Elegant and magnificent edifices are raised on foundations of slime. Ferguson was describing the linear march of progress from rude nations to property-based civilization. But as I've attempted to show, foundations of slime open up non-linear and non-triumphalist ecologies of impermanence. The swampy muds bubble up into the foundations of Amsterdam's Grand Canal houses, which were built with wealth accrued from the transatlantic slave trade. The muds seep into the reclaimed land of the rugby stadium, making a mess of differentiation. They are gradually swallowing up the marsh ruins, as Buchanan always imagined they would. They make contact with Mombasa's sunken textiles, enacting decomposition as a means of inscription, and becoming ghosts who announce that the past is still very much present. In the words of Toni Morrison, "You know, they straightened out the Mississippi River in places to make room for houses and livable acreage. Occasionally, the river floods these places. Floods is the word they use. But in fact, it is not flooding. It is remembering. Remembering where it used to be. All water has a perfect memory and is forever trying to get back to where it was." So that's the end of the essay, and I'm just going to do some brief descriptions for the images that accompany the text. There are 8 images in total, and the first one is part of a series of photographs from Jota Mombasa documenting work in progress for one of her sunken textile pieces. And the image shows a close-up of some fabric that is still wet with slime and mud, and it's been laid out on the grass after being pulled up from the river. The colors on the fabric are pink and gray and black or charcoal, and they're kind of swirling together. The second image that appears in the text is from Male Fantasies, Volume 1 by Klaus Teveleit. It's a black and white image of a vintage postcard showing a train crossing the Hindenburg Dam, and the train tracks are surrounded by tumultuous waters. The third image is a photograph of Beverly Buchanan's marsh ruins from 1981, photographed by Amelia Grimm in 2019. It shows the concrete boulders nestled among tall grasses in a wetland area, with water behind the boulders reflecting the sky above. And then the remaining 5 images are all from Mombasa's work in progress shots. The first shows Jota at the top of a spiral staircase on the outside of a building, and she's holding one of her ghosts or sunken textiles, and it looks like a big dirty tongue, all pink and muddy. Next, there's a photograph of an anonymous figure in black pulling one of Mombasa's sunken textile bundles up out of the water. The water is murky and bubbling. The next image shows Mombasa inspecting or arranging one of the textile pieces, which has been suspended, maybe as it's being dried out. The fabric is frayed and torn, and the mud has left intricate patterns. Then there is an image which is similar to the image that appeared at the very top of the essay, with the wet, muddy textiles laid out on the grass. And here we see more detail of the patterns left in the fabrics, with blacks and pinky reds and greeny grays. And finally, there's a photograph taken from an elevated perspective of a series of the muddy ghosts or sunken textiles drying out on these kinds of stands. Their colors are pink and brown, and there's some kind of protective floor cover on the ground below them, which is dark green and defiled by mud.